From the Mutual Broadcasting System, this is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and this will probably be my final STRAT of 2025, since we're on the cusp of 2026, and I'm going to kind of dive into what has been, I think, a dominant story, one of the dominant things certainly for the last few years, but definitely now. As you may know, President Trump has been pushing for peace yet again. After he's, I don't know how many times he's tried saying he's going to try and do a peace deal. You know, famously last August, they had that red carpet treatment of Putin in Alaska and everything. And yeah, Putin plays along with it, but I would say Putin definitely applies his human intelligence skills to, quote, play Trump, unquote, to try and get him to do what he wants him to do in his international bidding. And for whatever reason, Trump seems amenable to some of this. So anyway, he put out a 28-point plan. This was put out in latter November. And the 28-point peace plan, which was kind of based on the concept of the 20-point plan that the U.S. had put forward in the Middle East for Gaza, which I should mention is kind of hit a stall pattern. It hasn't really gone very far. They got the phase one thing kind of kicked in, but they're not even through phase one. There's still things incomplete with that. And they have definitely not made a lot of progress towards phase two. But anyway, he put this 28-point plan out there. All right. And it was done between the White House administration, Witkoff, Jared Kushner, the Russians, and had no Ukrainian or European involvement. It rather acquiesced to many Russian demands that President Zelensky of Ukraine objected at many times. He said, no, I can't do this, including giving up large pieces of sovereign Ukrainian territory. Now, Putin, who had kind of orchestrated this whole thing, from what I can tell, welcomed the proposal publicly after it was announced, saying this could form the basis of a peace settlement. Well, yeah, it was kind of the Russian position, which I can tell you that was causing a lot of bipartisan concern in Congress as to why we were basically putting this out there. Now, the proposal said that it will confirm Ukrainian sovereignty, but also stating that Crimea, which was part of Ukraine, and the Luhansk and Donetsk regions, or oblasts, the provinces, which comprise the Donbas region that you hear about and I'll talk about, will be recognized as de facto, not de jure, but de facto Russian land, including recognition by the United States. And this sort of de facto recognition stuff has happened many times in the past. Now, according to the proposal, the borders of the other two regions that are Russian occupied, Kherson and Zaporizhia, they don't control the whole thing, but they would be frozen along the front lines. Now, because Russia does not control all of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, the plan would be to see Ukraine basically withdraw from these oblasts, these provinces altogether, and give them up to Russia. That would include this iron belt, this defensive belt zone in Donetsk oblast that the Russians have never, ever been able to get through. It is I'm not going to say it's completely impenetrable, but it's just something that the Russians have had no success getting through, and obviously not a position due to terrain and a lot of other reasons that the Ukrainians would ever want to withdraw from, all right? So, anyway, this is what was put forward. The withdrawal zone would be considered neutral and recognized as belonging to Russia, which is another way of saying de facto Russian control over that entire territory. What this would do for Putin politically is he could claim that he was successful, that he went in there, he, you know, quote, liberated the Donbas from Ukraine, that he took all these other territories, that he secured the Crimea, which he considers part of Russia historically going back centuries and centuries. And so he would claim some sort of victory with that. The Ukrainians, on the other hand, would be left with this really strange arrangement where the Russians would have basically bypassed this major defensive belt without firing a shot, and then they would be within striking distance of Kyiv at some future point, and Russia had never, ever said that they weren't going to try and take over all of Ukraine at some point in the future. So everybody saw this thing as basically setting up just a third invasion. Now, Putin might wait until, you know, 2029, January, when, you know, when Trump is out of office, and then the next day he could turn around and launch an invasion, you know. Who knows? I mean, he launched this thing in February of 2022, so the idea of a winter offensive certainly is not something the Russians won't do. So who knows what would happen, but it definitely would put Ukraine in a terrible place. Anyway, so what came of this was there were meetings in Berlin, Witkoff, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. There were meetings with the Ukrainians, there were meetings with the Russians, Zelensky went over and met with the Europeans. The Europeans were talking to the White House as well. And so it was a lot of discussion back and forth. And the Europeans at the same time put forward a lot of stuff that would support Ukraine separate apart from whatever the U.S. would do. A lot of money, a lot of support. And a matter of fact, this meeting where basically President Zelensky flew into Florida and met President Trump at Mar-a-Lago, was along the way, Zelensky met with Prime Minister Carney of Canada. Canada doesn't have a lot of resources, but they did pledge $2.5 billion worth of resources to support, in this case, the reconstruction effort. But reconstruction does have a strategic military value, because what they're talking about is reconstruction of energy resources. So what that means is as the Russians are basically pounding and destroying the grid system, the energy infrastructure of Ukraine, the Canadian support would come in to rebuild that as quickly as possible. So they're actually, even though it's not technically military, it does have a military value. So anyway, all of this was going on. Zelensky came back with a 20-point plan, all right, that was a little bit different. This was came out of all these discussions. This was not brand new to the White House. They knew what the 20 points were, and they met in Mar-a-Lago to talk about this. Now, recap, remember, the U.S. plan called for Crimea, Luhansk, Donetsk to be recognized Russian territory, and Crimea and all of Luhansk are currently, and mostly, almost all of Luhansk are occupied by Russia. Not all of it, there is some that's still held by the Ukrainians. All right, so keep that in mind, all right? And then the Ukrainian forces would withdraw from parts of the Donetsk, which they control. That was the 28-point plan. Now, under Zelensky's plan, which came out of these discussions, and I almost hate to call it Zelensky's plan because it actually was something that was talked about with Witkoff, Kushner, was talked about with the Europeans, that the fighting in Donetsk will be halted at the current line of control, the current battle lines, with Russian and Ukrainian forces withdrawing to create a demilitarized zone overseen by international forces. I don't know who those forces are. It's not quite clear how you'd even put that into place. All right, but that's the plan. The same goes for Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson Oblast, that they too would be, they'd stop where the fighting is. As I mentioned, not all of Luhansk is completely controlled by the Russians, even though the Russians say they do control the whole thing, they don't. Zaporizhia and Kherson, they absolutely do not control the whole thing. And so that would stop. And Russia would also withdraw their forces from some of these other places like Kharkiv Oblast and up in the Sumy Oblast area and various other areas where they made these minor incursions. They would simply just withdraw altogether. Now, Zelensky's plan also has $800 billion coming in from somewhere in aid to rebuild its infrastructure economy after the war. And Ukraine would ramp up talks with the U.S. on a free trade agreement. All right. Ukraine is also proposing his country splits control the Zaporizhia power plant. Now, the Trump administration called in the 28-point plan U.S., Ukraine, and Russia to jointly operate that massive plant. I think it's got six reactors, as I recall. Zelensky's proposal instead calls for Ukraine to receive half the energy produced at the plant while the U.S. would allocate the other half. And it kind of leaves the Russians like, probably not getting any energy at all, or potentially unless the U.S. wants to sell energy to the Russians, which I don't rule out completely, but that would be what the plan was there. Zelensky's plan also calls for Ukraine, as I mentioned, to get $800 billion in aid for infrastructure after the war. Now, there's a lot of questions here as to how would this come about, all right? And then also the demilitarized zone. The international forces monitoring the demilitarized zone, how would that come about? Who would they be? And when you're talking about international forces in the demilitarized zone, you're going to put either European, U.S., or some international troops with boots on the ground between the Russians and Ukrainians. So that's kind of what that means. Traditionally, large demilitarized zones with international peacekeepers involved mean the peacekeepers are right in the middle between the two sides. And so they would be right there. And I'm not sure if the Trump administration is willing to do that. Okay, it doesn't sound like something that he would want to do. Now, the EU has put forward a two-year plan with $105 billion in loans going to Ukraine. Not quite sure how they're going to collateralize those loans. They couldn't reach a deal with Belgium and the Euroclear bank that's held in Belgium to use the frozen Russian assets to collateralize that loan. There was a big plan to do so. I was a big fan of it. I thought it was a great idea, but they weren't able to convince the Belgians about that. And part of it is, this is kind of it's not secret. And one would say it's a dirty secret, but it's not a dirty secret. It's just not that secret, is that Belgium is able to tax some of these frozen assets. And so they've been able to augment their domestic budget, their national budget, through tax revenues coming from these assets. So they're really not keen to liquidate these assets because this has been something of it's not a windfall, but it is something that Belgium gets money from. There's also some challenges that's been out there with European Union unity. Certainly Hungary has been playing kind of the odd man out, Slovakia as well. And there is a general tilt going on in European politics to the right, which means that some of these countries that were strongly aligned with Ukraine are having some political figures step in that actually have some degree of friendliness, for lack of a term. I don't quite what I want to say. But anyway, they don't seem to be as strongly anti-Russian as some of the others, with some exception. Meloni, the prime minister of Italy, she has actually kind of surprised everyone in a lot of different ways. And she's been a pretty strong supporter of Ukraine. On the other hand, she also, even though she's a little bit further to the right, and generally you would say that she and Trump get along very well because of her politics, she also recently said something about Europe is going to have to kind of part ways with the U.S. and develop its own strategic, pursue its own strategic objectives in so many different words. And it was rather interesting, coming from all things from Meloni. I would have thought she would have stayed fairly aligned with whatever President Trump was saying, but she was basically articulating something that was very different. All right. Now, some of the amounts that were considered in the loan idea was, I think I heard one thing for $165 billion was talked about, then it was dropped down to like $95 billion. But again, that's not something being done now. Of course, another option was to simply liquidate the Russian assets, but doesn't appear to be enough unity of effort or unity of agreement, I should say, to do that across the board. And they're very concerned that something that immediate and draconian could have second and third order effects on the global economy. All right. Now, Russia's got some problems. First off, they've been trying to form a strategic reserve. This was what the Institute for the Study of War has been watching. If they had a large strategic reserve, then if they made a breakout at somewhere along the Ukrainian lines, theoretically they could take this large strategic reserve and push it through, and maybe they can make a big movement and take a lot of terrain in Ukraine. Well, they've been unable to do so for a lot of different reasons. A lot of it has to do with recruiting, training, lack of resources. Another thing is Russia's got an armor deficit. Yeah, they're producing some tanks and other things, but they're just not producing enough of them. And they've been going through all the inventory, all those World War II war stocks that they have. They've been pulling those out. They've been trying to make them something on the battlefield. They have taken horrendous casualties putting Russian troops in these old vehicles in this modern battlefield environment, with first-person view drones taking out these old armored vehicles left and right. So they've been taking huge hits on that, and so that's a problem. Also, Ukraine has been doing a number of rather interesting deep strikes, to include some recent deep strikes going after drone production in Russia. One of the problems they've had is they keep getting these huge waves of drones, sometimes 500, 600 drones come over in one night, and they'll hit Kyiv and other locations throughout. And even though the air defense system in Ukraine is pretty robust, they simply get overwhelmed with these massive waves, and a lot gets through. So, along with putting up a lot of interceptor drones, and this seems to be the way to go, is to put lower cost interceptor drones up there to intercept the Russian drones. The other thing they're looking at is using some of these deep strike drones to go in there and take out these Russian drone manufacturing and missile component manufacturing facilities throughout Russia. This has been so effective, this deep strike capability by the Ukrainians. It caused a little bit of confusion because Trump actually, he was talking about, what the Russians have been doing or someone asked him about what the Russians are doing to Ukraine. And then he said, well, there's been some deep strikes that the Ukraine has been doing in Russia. And he says, I'm not saying this is a criticism or something like that. And it was rather interesting. It was almost like a tip of the hat. It's like, well, the Ukrainians are kind of given as good as they take. Well, the reality is, they're definitely making some inroads. But when you look at the sheer volume of what Russia's throwing out there, it's very, very tough. But they've been very, very effective. I think there's 38 major oil refineries, as I recall, in Russia. They have hit over half of those, is my understanding, and it could be as much as 40%, somewhere between 10 to 40. It's a huge variance, but it could be as much as 40% of the Russian oil refinery capability has been taken offline due to these Russian attacks. That's pretty big. Now, the Ukrainians have long-range drones. They also have these Flamingo missiles, which are in many ways very similar to the capabilities of Tomahawk missiles. And President Trump mentioned that he made the decision not to send Tomahawk missiles, which we all knew. The Ukrainians have these Flamingo missiles, so they're able to do many of the things that they would have done with the Tomahawk missiles. They've also been doing a number of very successful strikes using the Storm Shadow missiles provided by Great Britain. And Great Britain and France have basically told Ukraine in so many words, just go ahead and do whatever you got to do with these missiles we've provided you. And that's exactly what Ukraine seems to be doing. All right. Europe is stepping up. Europe's economy isn't quite as big as the United States in terms of gross domestic product, although by some other measurements, economic measurements, Europe's economy is very comparable and in certain metrics actually even bigger than the U.S. So they have a tremendous amount of capability. Rheinmetall, one of the biggest manufacturers of weapons based in Germany, is going gangbusters. Their stock prices through the roof. They've been putting out a ton of stuff, and you're seeing all these countries stepping up in a major way across Europe to increase the amount of capability they have. And there's a recognition that if there is a war with Russia, that the U.S. may not be there. So they're definitely not betting on the U.S. Nobody's coming right out and saying, well, the U.S. is dropping the ball. But what they are doing is they're basically doing all those things you would say if you were not going to count on the U.S. saving you. Which, again, I kind of go back to, if I may, that was always an objective of the first Trump administration and this Trump administration, was to get the Europeans to stand up to the Russians on their own without doing all these things that were simply, oh, well, the Americans will come and save us. And the U.S. has been saying, look, we got a lot of other commitments elsewhere around the world. We can't come and if you're not going to invest in your own defense, why should we come and save you? I know that's pretty harsh, but that's basically what we're saying, which is you got to step up and build a credible defense on your own. And that's what the Europeans are doing. In many ways, I kind of think of it as like making sausage. Nobody likes to watch sausage being made, but the outcome is that the Europe is going to be much more capable of deterring a Russian attack on its own without the U.S., without having to point to the U.S. every single time. And that's probably a very positive thing. Now, this is all being felt in Asia. Obviously, they're watching what's happening with the U.S. commitment to NATO, which was our biggest alliance. And countries like South Korea and Japan are very concerned. Obviously, President Trump's personal relationship with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, the dictator up there, has South Korea, always has had South Korea a little bit concerned about that. And so what you're seeing is something rather interesting. Is, as some of you may know, I've done a lot of military stuff in South Korea. I was based in Japan a couple different times and went back and forth a lot between the two countries. And there's a lot of historical animosity there because Japan ruled over South Korea, or ruled over the Korean Peninsula as a whole, you know, between the two world wars. And it was not, and it did not go well. It was not a pleasant experience for the Koreans. So there's been a lot of animosity by the Koreans for the Japanese. But they do seem to be finally overcoming this. Now, one could say it's because all the World War II veterans, you know, it's basically escaping living memory of what happened. So no one can remember it directly. Those who do have some memory are so old that they don't have a lot of influence, so it's all starting to change. But part of it's just by strategic necessity. They're looking at what's going on in the West Pacific. They're looking at what's going on in the East China Sea, South China Sea. Japan's actually saying what happens in Taiwan has a direct effect on Japan. That's very interesting. That is breaking out of Japan's previous position of we don't want to get pulled into something between Taiwan and China. South Korea hasn't quite said anything like that. South Korea doesn't want to get pulled into a war between Taiwan and China either. But with these two working together so closely, you're seeing that. And I think that's a direct relation to what they're seeing with the U.S. commitment in Europe and what they're seeing with going on in Ukraine. And they're saying, we've got to be more self-sustaining. We've got to be more resilient. And we can't build everything based on the plan that the Americans will come in and save our bacon if we don't have enough capability on our own to hold these guys at bay. And so that's what they're doing, and they're building it up. So it's rather interesting to see how this is having a global effect across the board. So at the end, kind of going with the title of this thing, will there be peace in Ukraine? Or will Ukraine be carved up into a lot of little pieces that Russia actually controls? I don't know. I also think, based on the cognitive warfare, the information operations being put out by the Kremlin at this point, that certainly Putin is laying the foundation to walk away from whatever is put before him. He has very maximalist goals. Putin is not as stable as a lot of people think. The Russian economy is in a lot worse shape than most people realize. Despite his incredibly draconian crackdowns, basically assassinating people left and right in Russia, if he even catches a whiff that they may have questions about his leadership or his control, despite all of that, there is definite discontent that's coming to the fore in Russia. And a lot of it's focused on Ukraine. And it's looking at the economy's doing poorly. He's basically liquidating the sovereign wealth fund because he can't get enough oil revenue to pay for the war, and economists have said this for some time, that sometime in late 2025 or in 2026 you're going to see the Russian economy start to stumble badly. I think it's already there. I think they're already stumbling badly, and I think he's got a real problem with this. And of course, the other thing is, and this is why the Europeans are a little nervous, he doesn't really have an exit strategy for this war economy. Even if peace is declared in Ukraine, he can't turn around right away and shift the economy back to what it was prior to February 2022. It is stuck in this war economy thing that he's made. So he's almost kind of built in a trajectory where if things freeze in Ukraine, he's got to look elsewhere. And of course, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia will tell you, well, we know where he's looking. He's looking at the Baltic states, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. And so that's kind of That's the big concern. And if I was sitting in Estonia, which is a very flat country, no natural barriers to a Russian armored invasion, I'd be very nervous. And they are. And so are the Lithuanians, and so are the Latvians, and they're building these huge defensive belts in anticipation of what's coming down. Anyway, will there be peace, or will we see Ukraine in pieces? I don't know. And could, if this thing completely falls apart, would this be the time that President Trump actually does walk away from any deal? It's very possible. I don't rule that out either. Although, one of the things that came out of this meeting in Mar-a-Lago was a reiteration of the economic opportunities that come from Ukrainian and U.S. cooperation. President Trump is a businessman, and I think that kind of resonates in his ears. Thanks for listening to Strat. Also, please visit stratpodcast.com and go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV. And you can always go to my corporate website, Global Risk Intelligence Planning is the name of the firm, but www.gripsa.com.